All right, hello. How's that? Forget to turn my microphone on. Put it on. Hello. I go around and greet everyone. Looks like we're 34 people. Wow. I don't know if that's a record, but it might be close. I will go around and greet people because most folks can't see everybody. If you're on a phone, you can only see four people. A tablet's like 9. A laptop's maybe 12. On a full computer, I believe I can see up to 49. So I can see everybody. So I will start by saying hello to Sandy and Chrissy, Mary, Daiko. Nice to have you join us. Bob O. Karen. Yeshe Soki. Shoketsu. John in Texas. Fane. Mark W. Peter. Jim. Marv. Bob K. Sam, Mick, Ken, Phil, Joan, Pat, Bruce, So-on, Paulette, Katie, and
Michael.
Ren Michael. I just got to read the screen. Charles, Abdullah, Amanda, Amelia, Linda, Candace, and Ruth Ann. Cool. Well, welcome everyone. People from the Pacific Northwest and people from all over the world. That's pretty cool. Let's see. In terms of announcements, we do have a one-day retreat coming up in January. I believe it's the 23rd, Saturday. If you want to know about these kinds of events and you aren't already on our weekly email newsletter list, you can go to the website and sign up that way because we let you know about that kind of thing. On the website is the schedule for that one-day retreat, which you can participate in the whole thing or you can participate in just part of it. And it has communal practice that we do together, scheduled practice that we do on Zoom, and then, you know, independent practice recommendations for how to spend the time on your own and silent work and rest and things like that. Also, I have filled in the basics of the 2021 calendar for Brightway. You can, so the basics for 2021 are filled in, and pretty much all the details are filled in through June. So within the next few months, look and see that we should have a term student program. There's other one-day retreats. There are ceremonies. I have moved a few things around in case you checked that recently. I did move, I believe I moved our precept ceremony where people can formally become Buddhists. I moved it to toward the end of June. A kind of in case we are not meeting in person indoors until then, in which case June is a better time than May to have an outdoor ceremony like we did last time. And let's see. So let's just pray that by the summertime, we can start to meet in person. And we have a few more classes left in our Tuesday class series using Norman Fisher's book, The World Could Be Otherwise, the Bodhisattva Path and the Paramitas. After that, so this is on the website and it'll also be referred to in the newsletter. We will do a seven week series that I'm calling Foundational Buddhist Teachings. And the kind of source material for that, if you want to do additional reading or study, it will be my podcast episodes, which are also written. So those ones are also written, so you can read or listen. And then after that, we'll start our annual precept study in preparation for the precept ceremony. All right. Any questions or other announcements or anything like that? All right. All right.
Looks like we have a question.
Yeah, yeah.
Ken, you had a question?
Oh.
Yeah, thank you very much for noticing. And this is way out in left field here, maybe. Can precept studies and the precept ceremony be done from Spain?
Well, definitely the study. Last year, I did start thinking about as we went online like this, and we're committed, even when we start being able to have in-person meetings, we're still committed to having, you know, virtual participation be possible. So it's like, huh, so what do we do about the people who want to take the precepts? And I'm guessing that we're just going to have to come up with an online, which frankly, there were several people last year who, even though they were local, they didn't feel safe coming to the ceremony. So we did do it remote. I mean, they participated remotely in the ceremony, and then I delivered their Wagesa and put it over their head. So I think if people are at a long distance, I think what I need to do is, like, each, if you want to take the precepts like that, you're going to have to recruit somebody else to be involved. Somebody else will have to put that Wagesa over your head.
Oh,
you should like be all by yourself and put the Wagesa over your head. So somebody else will stand in as a proxy for me.
But they don't have to be a Buddhist themselves.
No.
Oh, okay, that's great. You just made my day.
Sweet. All right. Good question. So for the sake of the recording and posting to the website, which I should mention that all our classes and Dharma talks, unless there's some kind of technical issue, end up being recorded and posted to the website. So for the sake of that recording, I'm calling this talk The Forgotten Virtue of Decorum. So the reason for that will become clear. So this week, as we all know, there was a violent assault on our Capitol by people trying to not just protest, but actually trying to stop a core democratic process of our country. And when I heard about this, I felt very violated and angry. And I have anger issue, but it's usually just directed at inanimate objects. I rarely just feel anger directed at people. And this was one of those rare, just briefly, I mean, we're all different, but just briefly, it was just like, ooh, if I could just get my hands on, like, which was kind of a shock for me in a way, because I don't usually feel that. And I certainly, I'm very critical of our government. I think it's very, very flawed. So I never really expected to feel protective of our capital and of our lawmakers and of our process. It's, you know, I felt protective of that. And I think what was particularly, I guess, adding insult to injury was the attitude of the people who took part in the riot or insurrection or whatever you wanted to call it, was kind of a joy and satisfaction at the discomfort they were causing, a kind of a big F you to whoever they thought they were offending. As we all know, various kinds of t-shirts and flags and messages that were overtly, you know, racist or antagonistic, you know, messages meant to antagonize and alienate, pointless vandalism, you know, striking fear into lawmakers and staffers. I mean, I was thinking about it, and you know, from the outside, what we were able to see with the news made it pretty obvious that these were a bunch of really disorganized people that were just trying to cause a commotion. But I thought about it from the point of view of the people inside the building. They didn't know that, you know, and we regularly in our country have horrific mass shootings. There's no reason why the people in the building wouldn't think that, you know, this was really serious. And it was serious. I mean, so, you know, the question in this country and around the world is, how do we respond? How do we respond to this increasing antagonism and violence and division? How do we restore peace? It sometimes feels like we don't have a lot of options because our political system is designed. It's a combative system. It pretty much leaves us only one option: to fight until we have 51%, and then we can get our way. And then the other side will fight and they'll get 51%, and we'll just kind of go back and forth in this fight. Okay, that's one option. It's not like we can rely on the media to heal differences, because, you know, we're siloed in different types of media. There's no one source that is viewed as authoritative and that everyone hears from. We fundamentally disagree with many of the beliefs on the other side, whatever side we're on, the other side. And we just cannot bring ourselves to compromise while maintaining our integrity. So do we respond to essentially domestic terrorists with, like, overindulgent parents? Like, oh, they were upset about something. Let's find out what they were upset about. And maybe we can appease them and maybe they'll stop doing that. You know, like, fingers crossed that they don't just, like, get the upper hand and we encourage that bad behavior. So I'm not saying that I have any easy answers to any of those questions, but let's talk about how it can be helpful to examine our negative responses to the actions of others and identify what's underneath our anger, outrage, or fear. And if we're honest with ourselves, and this is, you know, at this kind of broader level in terms of society, but also at personal level, if we're honest with ourselves, we often, and I haven't had time to think about this, but maybe always, we find a sincere desire for other people to treat us and the beings and the things and the places that we care about, a sincere desire for other people to treat us with respect. And this desire for respect reflects our interdependence with others. So if we want situations to improve, we can't respond to conflict with the same disrespectful behavior others have shown. even though that might be our first inclination. So responding with disrespect will only inflame the situation and create more division. Instead, we have to acknowledge our hurt and act in accord with interdependence, making use of the fact that, and this is what's difficult to get our minds around, and we have to kind of take it on faith because our opponents, whatever, who's ever on the other side or ever we're in conflict with, they're not going to admit this probably, but they want our respect too. So it's kind of scary and counterintuitive to respond to negative behavior by acknowledging and confessing our vulnerability. But we can learn to do this with dignity and strength, because needing others is not a weakness, it's a reality. Others may pretend they don't need anyone or don't care at all what you think or do, but this is either ignorance or a facade. So this made me think of a passage in the Norman Fisher book that we've been studying on Tuesdays, The World Could Be Otherwise. So this was in a chapter on patience, on the perfection of patience, particularly when he was talking about anger and how patience is, you know, alternative to holding on to anger. And this was on a little section on conflict. He says, I have come to believe that there is a drop of love at the center of every conflict. We all need and want love. We all know that love lies at the center of who we are as human beings. We all understand the imperative to love the other as ourselves, however much we have forgotten or deny this. So when the other seems to be threatening us, there is a disturbing disconnect with something that lies deep within us, our intense need for one another. This is why severe conflict seems to rock us to our very foundation, much more than the issue at hand may seem to warrant. At the bottom of every important conflict is a sense of love having been betrayed. The magic of conflict is to recognize that there is a point of connection and even love at the heart of what is most painful. Because we care so deeply for one another, however much we may not be in touch with this caring, we are capable of hurting one another. Once we know this, we can search within for the heart and hurt and vulnerability. It is there somewhere, underneath the anger, defensiveness, or aggression. If we can let ourselves feel the hurt, grief, fear, and disappointment, eventually we will find the love, that place within us that contains the basic human feelings we all feel for one another. So our need for respect, love, you know, love at the core, however you want to call it, love might seem like a little bit too much, but that we need respect from individuals as an individual, and we need respect from one another as members of groups or as citizens. So in terms of the individual, it's like we have such an individualistic society that, you know, in a way, it's held up as a good thing not to give a shit what other people think, right? And yet, if you just, you know, go about your errands and you see somebody get really pissed off at somebody else cutting them off in traffic, or and then somebody flips somebody else the bird, and oh, like you see that inflaming of responses, or you get involved with it yourself, and in a way, like, that is a sign we do care, right? I know I remember once walking my dogs in Portland, and my little female dog took a pee, but when female dogs pee, it looks a little bit like they're taking a poop. And this guy across the street started yelling at me for letting my dog poop and not picking it up. And he was just like, just swearing at me, and like immediately, you know, I'm like, she's not. So we're yelling, and then he drives away, and like all the, you know, for like an hour, I'm just jittery like this. But I recognized how much of it is like a sense that like he's wrong. I'm not that kind of person. I'm not the kind of person that lets my dog poop on the street and not pick it up. And so this had to do kind of with my relationship with this person, even though he was a stranger, that he would think so little of me, and that he would be angry with me. And there's something about a connection gone wrong. Otherwise, you know, I wouldn't care.
May I pause and ask a clarifying question?
Yeah.
I'm failing to see a connection between an armed invasion and dog poop. Like, okay, these seem like vastly inappropriate comparisons to make.
Yeah, yeah.
And okay, I trust you're getting at something, which is why I asked.
Right, but right. Yes, I'll respond to that briefly now, but then I'll also just keep it in mind as I unfold the talk. So, I guess what I would say is I'm getting at respect right now, and our need for it on the personal basis. And then it's another thing entirely as to how we manifest that toward the people who just did the armed insurrection. And I will also, you know, of course, give the disclaimer, which I'll talk about later as well, that like this has nothing to do with the practical steps that we take to call people, to hold people accountable, or to stop them from doing something harmful. Absolutely has no bearing on that. So I'll definitely revisit that if it doesn't become more clear. So I was just thinking about ways that respect manifests. And I feel like this applies both at the personal and at the larger societal level. These are just some of the ways that I could think of. It manifests as friendliness, the kind of friendliness that Bob Oda's been talking about lately, you know, just a goodwill. You are a human being, and I'm going to respect that basic fact. Kindness, generosity, basic esteem, a willingness to listen to and take into account another's perspective. It manifests as honoring someone's physical and emotional boundaries and property. It manifests as refraining from destroying or needlessly denigrating those things that someone values. That maybe sometimes criticism is necessary, but respect means we don't just, you know, needlessly badmouth or criticize or make fun of something that people really care about. Valuing someone's basic humanity and therefore doing what we can to ensure that they're able to live with a measure of safety and comfort and dignity. So we need respect from individuals, as individuals, as well as members of our group or society. And this need is emotional, but it's also very literal and material, as you can kind of see. Like, we're all interdependent in a very real way. It has an emotional dimension to it, but it has a very practical dimension to it as well. We're completely interdependent with one another, perhaps more so now than at any point in human history. So to get to decorum. So there are many ways to demonstrate disrespect. But over the last, particularly 5 years in the US, there has been a dramatic increase in public behavior demonstrating a complete lack of decorum. Decorum can be defined different ways, but is what I like to say, dignified conformity to social standards about what is appropriate and polite. So dignified conformity to social standards about what is appropriate and polite. A couple different definitions. Behavior that is socially correct, controlled, calm, and polite. Propriety and good taste in conduct or appearance. Dignified propriety of behavior, speech, or dress. And propriety, then, is conformity to established standards of good or proper behavior or manners. Appropriateness to the purpose or circumstances, suitability. So my sense is that this virtue has become viewed by people across the political spectrum as rather quaint and outdated. Except, I was thinking, like, except within the context of employment. We're still kind of, okay, that's fine. My employer can expect me to dress and act in particular ways. But outside of that, it just sounds kind of, yeah, like something that we've left behind. We're better than. And it's good reason to be skeptical of this, right? Socially enforced expectations of behavior can and have been brutally oppressive to individuals and groups of people. But I think in throwing decorum out the window, I mean, we've had a president for 4 years who is like anti-decorum. That is like, if anything defines him, it is anti-decorum. A president who has done that. So we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater, perhaps? And the question, doesn't a certain level of decorum reflect and honor the web of mutuality in which we live? The way that when I do something, I'm going to take into account what the people around me expect and what appropriate behavior is considered and how it's going to be received. And how my actions are going to impact the people around me. And even if I don't really agree with you or value what you value, I'm going to be polite. I'm going to constrain my behavior in some way in order to make space for harmony. So in Buddhism, we have... decorum has an interesting place. So it shows up in the Abhidharma, which is not something that I have deeply studied or been deeply drawn to, that it's Buddhist philosophy. It's been around since very early on. And it's basically teachings, Buddhist teachings that are presented without literary devices or speakers. So it's not the Buddha said or somebody said, and it's not, you know, like a mythological parable or anything like that. It's just this bare bones. So it's very dry and very intellectual, if you will, but can be very thought provoking. So the Abhidharma contains lists of dharmas, and these are the fundamental elements of existence or reality, according to the Abhidharma. It doesn't really matter if you understand that or believe that at this point. But you could just picture these super reflective, intellectual Indian Buddhists just spend full time contemplating our existence and, you know, breaking it down to like, well, here's the different elements of existence that are always here or whatever. So they categorized the dharmas. So sometimes there's 75 of them, sometimes it's 96 of them, whatever. But a well-known list has 75, the Abhidharma Kosha, and includes like 5 sense faculties, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, 5 sense objects, form, sound, smell, taste, mind, and there's 46 mental factors, which I'll get into. 14 elements that are neither substantial forms nor mental functions, life, birth, impermanence, and three in unconditioned factors like space. Just to give you a little taste. So the mental factors are further categorized into neutral mental factors, feeling, will, attention, wholesome mental factors, faith, energy, non-greediness, afflicted mental factors, ignorance, anger, arrogance, and indeterminate mental factors such as drowsiness, lust, and doubt. So what that this is the part I find interesting is the categorization, the way that they saw these different mental factors as figuring into positive or negative behavior. So a mental factor like delusion is categorized as an omnipresent afflicted factor. That it's when you have a destructive mind state, it's present everywhere. And then mental factors like rage, stinginess, malice, and dishonesty are categorized as minor afflicted factors of wide extent. So in other words, when somebody has a destructive state of mind, these things are often there, but not always. And stuff like anger, attachment, and pride are even categorized as indeterminate mental factors. So they're not even necessarily identified as being bad. So there's only two mental factors that are categorized as major, omnipresent, unwholesome factors. So not just afflicted. Afflicted means, you know, it's like when you're afflicted with anger. Anger arises. It's an issue. Now you need to deal with it. What are you going to do with it? How are you going to process it? It's a little bit like, it's an affliction, but it's kind of, to some extent, there's not a whole lot you can do about the arising of these things. But unwholesome is based on the word akusala, meaning it's unskillful. Now there's some, there now there's some choice involved. Now there's some responsibility involved, and you're making the, a bad choice. So, or also these are called the two general functions of evil or unskillfulness. So this means that while the other factors may or may not be present in a destructive state of mind, these two always are. In every destructive state of mind, in every destructive action, these things are present. So the first one is a lack of conscience. Ahrikya, or lack of shame or lack of self-respect, lack of conscience. And the second one is anapatrapya, a lack of decorum, a lack of propriety, disregard. So I really like the way these are described by a Tibetan teacher. I found an article by him online. So the first one he calls no moral self-dignity, no sense of honor. He says it is a part of any of the three poisonous emotions, greed, hate, and delusion. It is the lack of any sense to refrain from destructive behavior because of caring how our actions reflect on ourselves. According to Vasubandhu, this mental factor means having no sense of values. It is a lack of respect for positive qualities or persons possessing them. And then the second one, no care for how our actions reflect on others, is also part of any of the three poisonous emotions. It is the lack of any sense to refrain from destructive behavior because of caring how our actions reflect on those connected to us. Some persons may include our family, teachers, social group, ethnic group, religious order, or countrymen. For Vasubandhu, this mental factor means having no scruples and is a lack of restraint from being brazenly negative. This and the previous mental factor accompany all destructive states of mind. So I think this is a really fascinating way to frame human behavior. I would imagine this is like a very early human, a very early Buddhist philosophical framing of what social psychologists are discovering today. Basically, we can feel and think all kinds of things, all kinds of negative stuff, all kinds of judgments, and it's really not all that bad. It's kind of just part of being human. We can feel angry and lustful and greedy and whatever. Arrogant, stingy, spiteful, lazy. But as long as we're restrained by our conscience and a sense of decorum, our negative thoughts and feelings will not be destructive, or too destructive anyway. So I guess what I recognized was that, I mean, there's a lot going on, of course, in what we saw this week, but I don't think we can overestimate the value of decorum, that what added insult to injury was just a sense that that the people part of that riot just didn't care. They were not operating within the structures of our society, that they were thumbing their nose at what we care about and respect and try to hold in common. So, like, decorum is arbitrary and socially defined. What is it appropriate to say? What is it appropriate to wear? What should you say on TV? What should the president say? What should lawmakers say? You know, I mean, things change over time, but it does reflect our existence within this web of mutuality. Individualism has value, but we don't exist independently of society. We don't create society by ourselves. Our tribe doesn't create society by ourselves. Like it or not, we need the cooperation of the other side in order to have a peaceful and life-sustaining society. Affirmation, friendliness, acceptance, kindness. We so want and need this from people. And from a few people is great, but we really do want it from everyone. So another example that I think of is, I knew two men who were a gay couple. They had been together 20, 25 years when, quite a number of years ago, a county in Portland briefly made gay marriage legal before it became legal nationwide. So just in our county, it was legal. And so they asked us at the Zen Center to perform a wedding ceremony for them. And unlike so many wedding ceremonies, like, the biggest deal was signing the little contract, right? Like, fine, we can do a little ceremony, but the being able to sign that contract was a big deal. And what I saw on that day was, like, even though this didn't really matter to their relationship, they loved one another, they lived with one another, so they didn't need, like, social acceptance, but, oh, how sweet to have it. How sweet to have that affirmation. How sweet to have our society embrace that and recognize that. And it made me frame this in a very different way. Instead of it being a right, damn you, we have the right, it's like, would you please accept us and affirm us? I mean, there's so many different ways that this kind of decorum, which we might disregard, just is incredibly profound. Maybe you might even say it's the opposite of what people talk about as, like, microaggressions, right? It's like, what are like micro compassions? When I go out in public and I'm shopping and I'm doing things, like, people don't stare at my bald head. They see I'm wearing funny clothes. Occasionally, they might just say in a polite way, like, oh, are you into a martial art? But for the most part, people are just, because it's polite, right? It's not polite to, like, be overly focused on, oh, you're weird, what the hell? And think of how much easier that makes it for me to just, you know, be out there in public. There's so many subtle things that we do for one another to just keep this social harmony. So we can't force respect. We have to ask for it. So unfortunately we do have to make laws and hold people accountable just because their behavior is out of line without question. And I think it was, Martin Luther King that was talking about, like, yeah. You know, we want to, you know, have love our enemies and all that. But in the meantime, before they actually show us respect, we're going to have to legislate that they do so, right? So yes, there's that. But at the deeper level, we can't force people to treat us with respect. We can't force them to restrain themselves out of conscience or decorum. And what can we do? I guess we can ask for it. We can recognize this as an enactment of our interdependence and behave accordingly. So for instance, I can recognize anyway, I don't know if you all see it similarly or not, but I can recognize that part of what hurt about last week was that lack of decorum, that it was just trashed and thrown out the window. And I can recognize that is that's some of the bad behavior that they showed. But that doesn't mean I have to throw decorum out the window. That I can, like, as Michelle Obama said, like, I can take the high road, right? To realize how treating one another with respect is so important. And therefore, that can be more of a value for me. And we may resist this because then it perhaps seems like we are putting the person what we want some respect from, and we're not receiving it. Maybe we're even receiving disrespect. Perhaps we're kind of putting them in a position of power. Like, we're vulnerable. I want your respect. And we're asking. So there's a little aversion to that whole thing, but we don't have to see it as putting people into some kind of superior position of power, but just recognizing that we're all interdependent, that what you say and do does affect me positively and negatively. So I didn't have time to write this out, but I just thought, you know, because I hopefully this hasn't been too seemed too abstract, but I was picturing, you know, in terms of the cultural dialogue in our country, which, you know, so many people are speculating, how do we heal, how do we talk to one another, how do we, you know, decrease the divisiveness, etc. I guess not saying this would be effective, but this is what I'm picturing. And if I, like, wrote a letter to the Capitol mob, and I didn't write it in terms of from a place of anger, I didn't write it from a place of you guys are terrible, stupid, fascist, cruel, whatever. But I wrote and I say, I love America. I'm proud of my country. It's irrational. But when I am at a sports event and we sing the anthem, and we put our hands on our hearts, I get teary. And I don't know what's made you so angry. but it really hurt. It hurt to see you trashing our capital, trashing the symbol of our democracy. How did we become so alienated from one another? I know you're good people. I know you treasure your families. I know you have your favorite foods and you like to cook for your family and you want to provide for your family. And I know we're not really so different. And I know you're just trying to make us angry, bait us with some of the things that you say. I know you, in your heart of hearts, don't really mean it. But it really, it hurts to think of how much you must hate us. We didn't mean to alienate you so much. We're scared. You're scared. It would be wonderful to be able to just get an apology. To know that you care too. Let's all go together and clean up the mess. I'm sure I could go on, but I think you get the gist. So, I guess to close, again, I'm not sure if I got my point across or not. It's a big bite to chew. But, yeah, I guess recognizing that web of mutuality that we're all bound in, and that we really do want love and respect from one another. But that's the positive thing then also, is that if I'm feeling that lack of respect and love and care from the other side wants it from us too. I'm not saying they deserve. I mean, it's not a matter of deserve, right? That's not what it's about. They do want it. And that is how we convert people, right? With love and respect, we don't convert them through coercion or shame. So, comments or questions? Find out what y'all are thinking.
I want to respond to your letter, your imaginary letter, which is really beautiful and apt. Before I respond to that, I want to add some personal context so folks know where this is coming from. So my parents are very deeply conservative folks and have supported Trump staunchly this entire time and still do. And they live in their own world. I remember back in the day, my mom going on about Vince Foster's suicide and spouting all of the conspiracy theories related to that. Like, she does not occupy the same reality we do. So when I talk about people who invade capitals, I've experience of this. My dad has a very large gun collection. This is something I know what I'm talking about. So what perturbs me when I hear this form letter about, to imagine that they're just trying to get out of a rise of us is dangerous, because this is not people trying to provoke a reaction. These are people trying to kill people. Like this mob, the first thing they did is they went to Senator Chuck Schumer's office, a Jewish man. So I mention this by way of saying, like, I really one of the things that I love and respect about this Sangha is that we do strive so hard to see and approach people with love, even whenever they're hurting, up to and including killing people. But I don't know what to take this away from this. It just feels understated for the seriousness of what happened. This is moved past a matter of trying to find dialogue. This is a matter of how do we get people to not kill us? And I don't know how to do that.
Thank you, Amanda. I just want to hear what you're saying and allow the truth of it to sink into all of us. So nothing that I say do I want to be a yeah, but.
Okay.
I think that is, and I think the seriousness of what happened is gradually coming out. You know, it is, yeah. So I definitely did not mean to minimize it. I guess, you know, it's, it requires cognitive dissonance. But an ambiguity. But we can take absolutely stern measures to stop harm and destruction, and still do it. And I would say we can take those measures, and it's not essential that we take those measures with a loving smile on our face. You know, there is a time and a place for anger as a motivator. So I'm not saying that, like, before we do anything, we need to feel happy and good and loving. That's not true. But it is possible to take those measures to arrest people, to put them in jail, to remake our whole system, to hold people accountable. While I guess what I'm speaking to is, how do we make sense of this in our own hearts? I know that when I first got involved in Buddhism, it was scary to me to look out and see people being horrible at many levels, personal violence to, you know, owners of oil companies to corrupt people. How could they do that? How can they do that? It made no sense. They were like a black box. So therefore I can't predict them. I can't relate to them. I can't talk to them. They are other. They are scary, scary other. And that is actually a scary place to be. Whereas Buddhism helped me frame it in terms of, everybody wants to be happy. Some people just go about it in goddamn the wrong frickin' way. It's because of ignorance. It's because of greed, hate, and ignorance. But fundamentally, that's what they are looking for. So for me, I guess it didn't, again, it's tricky when we talk about it, because it didn't excuse anything in any way, but it gave me some hope that some kind of connection or conversion or redemption or communication is possible.
Can I? So I don't want to make it more intense or sad, but I like a lot of, you know, like what I hear and when I think about like what to do, I'm a parent. I have two kids. And so I think of like, how do you parent your kid? Mm-hmm. And my son has some serious psychological disorders, and he is extremely violent sometimes. Mm-hmm. And he, been told by our his psychiatrist to hide the knives in our house because of the violence that he's capable of. And everything that I do to try to teach him, you know, comes from a place of love, but he's also capable of being very scary. And you know, ultimately, I think that's kind of like a metaphor for what's happening, you know, like he's just sick and he needs help. Mm. And he needs people to love him. And it's not going to fix everything. There's still behaviors that are inappropriate. But it has to come from a place of love. Like that's where it has to come from. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Thank you for sharing that. That's beautiful. That's a beautiful, like, because it is loving to constrain, right? It's loving to set the boundaries. In that context, that is love.
I was thinking about a conversation we had several years ago, which is, to me, I actually grew up not too awful far from where Amanda grew up. One of the things I was raised with that I am slowly relinquishing over time is I was raised to believe that violence was the last resort of the powerless, and that the right to violence had to be preserved for that reason. That anyone that tried to constrain or shame you away from your last resort was actually trying to take away your last resort. So I have a lot of sympathy for the devil, because that's where I was growing up, and that's what I've been getting away from for a very long time. But I've also found out throughout my adult life that it's possible to have every single privilege, because I do, and still feel powerless. Mm. That you can feel powerless in the midst of enormous power, and that can leave you reaching for your last resort in times that are wildly inappropriate. Mm. And after Charlottesville, I asked you, what did the Buddha in the Ashra realm offer? And because I had come into contact with the term Ashra before I got interested in Buddhism, and for various reasons, my brain translates it as destroyers. And as I recall, your answer was that the Buddha of the Ashra realm holds a sword so that he can enforce discipline. Mm. And that's what I keep coming back to, is that discipline that does not shame and justice that does not shame is the affirmation of a relationship, mm. right? That they owe us and we owe them for the sake of the relationship that is still there. And that's where I'm at, is we have to find a way to a discipline and a justice that restores without shaming. And that's what I hope for in the midst of all of this.
I think that's what, as you're speaking, I realize that's part of what made me choose to focus on decorum, because I thought, you know, I don't know about the capital mob, but I think conservatives would embrace that term as well. Thinking, what is a term for self-discipline that is noble, that is something that we can all relate to and respect. So in a way, like, I guess I'm kind of imagining, can we ask all people to take to value decorum more, to value more how we treat each other with respect. Even if we're to some extent just going through the motions, it is a sign of our interdependence, a sign of our mutuality. It's a gesture of respect.
Well, you know, one of the people that died, the man that had the heart attack, he was trying to steal a portrait of Tip O'Neill. And Tip O'Neill was a vociferous opponent of Ronald Reagan. And I mean, he would, you know, fight him to the end. But they said I don't know if it was Reagan's biography, that they were friends after 6 p.m. Mm-hmm. And so there was this collegiality, and that's just gone in Congress. And I saw a former white supremacist woman who's now become a professor, I think a sociology professor. She said, you know, she was talking about how do you get these people out of these cults? Because this is a cult that we're dealing with. These are lies, a cult. She said, you do things with them. You do things that have nothing to do with that. You go have pizza. You go for a walk. You know, you slow. It's like, I'm a human. I'm not a rat. I am a human being. They call us demon rats. You know, I've been on Parler. These people want, there are people, they want to kill us. They want to kill us. So there's that. But here's what disturbs me the most, is the insincere decorum that has led us here. It's the insincere decorum of Josh Hawley, the insincere decorum of Ted Cruz. You know, these people that are, we are just, you know, we need to get to the bottom of this issue. And, you know, that opens the door for that greed. It's just feeding greed, hate, and delusion. But you know, the bottom line, like you said, it really is, it's painful, it's difficult. I talk to Trump supporters all the time on Facebook. I do it all the time. And, you know, the bottom line is, if we think that what happened in Yugoslavia can't happen here, we're wrong. Because I've also been on Parler. I'm on Parler. These people, they're people, they want to kill us. So we're at the point where, you know, we can't just ban them and get rid of them. We need to let them know that we're human beings, you know? So this whole, we need to, you know, love, you can't change people with anything but love. It's painful and difficult, but it is true. And I've seen it happen. I know ex-white supremacists. It can happen. These people can change, but we can't if we just excise them from our lives. Anyway, that's my two cents. And that, you know, that's, there's a reason why these spiritual teachings last for thousands of years.
Well, that is definitely, it's definitely not the end of this conversation. It's not like, you know, we can possibly just sum it up or get the answers that we need in one Dharma talk, one discussion. But I really do, I appreciate being able to share this space with you all and to be able to bring this, because to bring this kind of thing into our Sangha space is, I mean, what else is our spiritual practice for? You know, if we ignore what's going on in the world and don't try to apply it, then this is just escapism, right? So I guess I wish you all strength and solace. And if you have any I don't know, if you have any topics or further discussion or something that you would like to see me, you know, focus on or address, just email me and let me know. And there's been a couple questions about the sources of various things that I read, and I will be doing my next podcast on this, you know, kill two birds with one stone kind of thing. So I'll have all the references in there.
don't kill a bird.
Okay, I won't.
Feed two birds with one feeder?
Yeah. All right, so it is 12:21, so I will just close with our closing verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Good talk, Domio. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oy vey.
Thank you.
Love you all. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks all.
Thank you, Domio.
Thank you.